May proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my name is Patrick Bousquet. It's an honor for me to be here today. A little bit surreal. I've watched so many cases being argued from the very back row back there when I was a clerk. Didn't think I would be up here so soon, but my partner, Russ Waters, is in a trial that lasted a little longer than we expected, and he asked me to be here, and I'm very pleased to get this opportunity. And the case that we're here to talk about today is one that I think boils down to a pretty simple, straightforward issue, and that is, can a trial court throw out a jury verdict based on perjury at trial when the uncontroverted evidence, the only real evidence, was that the witness's testimony was absolutely true? And I submit to the court that it cannot. The standard is set forth in several Supreme Court cases, including the Hancock case and the Loveless case, for perjury, for new trial based on perjury, is that the witness must willfully and deliberately testify falsely. The question isn't whether the testimony could potentially confuse the jury. The question certainly isn't whether the witness had additional information that he wasn't asked about, that plaintiff's counsel might have wanted to know about. It's whether he willfully and deliberately testified falsely.
Opposing counsel says you look at the context and the manner in which he said things, you look at the intangibles, and that the trial court found he was deliberately trying to deceive the court and the jury about the nature of his testimony in the Fort Hood case and about the subject of his testimony in the Fort Hood case. We grant a lot of discretion to trial courts to grant new trials, much more, opposing counsel cites cases saying, than we afford them in denying new trials. Can you please address those cases?
Sure. Well, I think that the standard review issue is significant because in this case I think there's a threshold issue, and that's whether the question that was asked of Mr. Aiken, and that question was, now can you give, just to give the jury an example of who you work for and what you do, are you currently involved in any major investigation where you've been retained by the U.S. government? Answer, I recently just finished reconstructing the Fort Hood shooting by Major Malik Hassan. The question wasn't asked, on whose behalf he represented or he performed his investigation.
Why could not the trial court draw the inference that he was trying to create the impression he was hired by the prosecution? Because that clearly is the impression everybody had there. Whether or not technically the government pays for everything, I mean, in effect, I think opposing counsel says a public defender could say they're representing the government, the state of Missouri, because they're hired by the state of Missouri, but people would think they were a prosecutor then, not a public defender, because that's not common parlance.
Well, right, but I think that the issue is, they try to argue that it doesn't have to be, an all-out lie, that it doesn't have, it can be just simply misleading in order to grant a new trial based on perjury. Last time I checked Webster's, false means not true. I mean, I think certainly if you ask my five-year-old, if you say something that's not true, what is it? And it's false. And that's the standard. Did you willfully and deliberately testify falsely? The testimony here simply was not false.
Well, it was false, as too. He was asked about blood spatter, and in fact what he did was reconstruct the bullets. Is that right?
There's no evidence of that. Absolutely no evidence of that. That was based on statements made by counsel at the new trial hearing. Counsel didn't have any. He said he had some sort of conversation with one of the trial lawyers for the Hassan case, and based on that conversation that he had with that trial lawyer, he says that, Aiken really didn't do blood spatter analysis. He did crime scene reconstruction. Well, first of all, blood spatter analysis is just one part of crime scene analysis. It's not something that's separate, so that wasn't a lie, wasn't even a deviation from the truth. Secondly, there was absolutely no evidence of that conversation. Unsworn statements by counsel at an argument on a motion for new trial is not evidence.
Can you address the cases suggesting we apply a different standard in reviewing grant of a new trial versus denial of a new trial for false testimony?
Well, I think that those cases just state the general rule that courts are more inclined to grant a new trial, to uphold the grant of a new trial rather than the denial, because if they uphold the denial, then the case is over. It's just a practical rule. I don't think that it's a hard line. How many more cases we accept when the issue is the grant of a new trial versus how many when it's the denial. I don't think that there's this heightened abuse of discretion standard. the standard is abuse of discretion, at least as to the discretionary issues, and we would argue that most of the issues in this case are not discretionary issues because they're questions of law. But for those discretionary issues, you know, the trial court cannot act arbitrarily. And our position is that in this case, under any standard of review, the trial court acted arbitrarily by granting a new trial based on testimony that was technically true, and completely true, and the only evidence to the contrary was unsworn statements of counsel that simply didn't qualify as evidence.
If the trial court in this case would have just said the verdict is against the weight of the evidence?
Well, that's a different motion, and it's a different standard.
It was the same standard. It was abuse of discretion. I thought you just told me it was the same standard.
Well, we argue that the standard and the threshold standard in this case is de novo review of whether a clear question, the question that was asked, required Mr. Akins to volunteer something that he was not asked.
Do you get the de novo?
Huh?
Some cases say there's a de novo standard?
The Keltner case, and it's a juror non-disclosure case, but they pulled that decision right out of federal perjury cases. And they say in federal perjury cases, any perjury case, you know, one of the key issues is, was a clear question requiring the witness to respond asked?
But this is not a perjury prosecution, and our cases are clear that if you're saying the trial court abused its discretion in denying a motion for new trial for perjury, you basically would have to have a perjury conviction or there has to be no alternative but that the person committed perjury. But they're much more deferential when the court has granted it.
I think they are much more deferential, but that doesn't mean that the standard doesn't apply. You still have to make a showing.
What if the trial judge just decided that this was the only witness who gave this type of testimony and I just don't believe him? Could the trial judge grant a new trial?
If it was the only witness and the trial judge didn't believe his testimony, I suppose that's possible. It's certainly not our case. There would have to still be a showing made with some sort of evidence.
How's the showing come from if the trial judge just decides that, you know, this person was not credible, the jury was hoodwinked, and therefore I think the verdict is against the weight of the evidence?
I think that's a different motion, and that's not the motion that was filed here. If it was a simple...
Did the motion itself... The motion for a new trial was its sole basis I understand that this particular witness lied.
Yeah, it was
about
newly,
his credentials.
Right, newly discovered evidence, which, you know, we can get to. It didn't meet the standards for newly discovered evidence, but it's also on perjury. I think perjury is a little bit different because you're not simply, saying that the evidence was against the weight, that the verdict was against the weight of the evidence. You're saying that this person lied in court. It's a very grave allegation affecting not only
your. You're arguing, or you're discussing with Judge Fisher, is that this trial court expressly said, he did not expressly say he was granting it because it was against the weight of the evidence. He expressly granted it because he said it was perjury.
Correct.
Are you also arguing that you think as a matter of law it is not perjury?
I think as a matter of law this was not perjury. And we cite some case law in our reply brief, the State versus Olson. It's not a Missouri case, but it does discuss cases from several other jurisdictions that says that it's the general rule that a perjury charge cannot be maintained where the testimony of the accused was literally, technically, or legally true.
And is that where you get your de novo review, because you're arguing it's a question of law?
Yeah, that's one basis. The other basis is when you're talking about clarity of language, when you're talking about did this question, the way it was asked, did it invoke in the witness a duty to volunteer information that he wasn't specifically asked? That's a question of law. That's something that the court should decide. Did that question require him to provide certain additional information he wasn't asked about?
No case that is granted a new trial has said you have to prove criminal perjury. You have to prove the only interpretation is that they lied. And Atlas are the facts said by Judge Fisher, where there were two different sets of witnesses, who one testified A, one B, and the jury went for A, and the trial court granted a new trial because they thought B was more accurate.
Yeah, I think
and we
that,
affirmed.
No, I agree, and I'm not arguing that necessarily that the criminal standard should apply, although the language is almost identical. The language from Loveless and from Hancock, willful and deliberate false testimony, is essentially the same. It has to be false. It has to be not true. It can't just be misleading. It has to be a lie.
And I mean, I don't know the answer to this. I want your input more simply than just saying it has to be perjury. Is there or should there be a distinction between criminal perjury, beyond a reasonable doubt, whatever those elements are, versus is that what we require for a new trial here, or could the trial court not decide it was willful and deliberate false testimony whether or not it was perjury?
Whether or not it was criminal perjury.
Right.
Well, I don't know. I don't. I do not think that we have to have a finding of criminal perjury. I think it would be a good rule, be a hard-line rule, and it would encourage, I mean, some of the reasons why you require absolutely clear evidence of perjury is because you want to encourage witnesses to testify. You want to encourage lawyers to do their job and elicit the testimony that will advance the case.
You indicated the term technically true. Is that enough to cover this so that he's not, it was your term, technically true or fully true, one way or the other, but if they're technically true and not giving full disclosure when they're asked the question, is that enough? Probably in perjury it is.
My position is that, yeah, I mean, that is enough if something is technically true, because otherwise you open the door to all sorts, I mean, it would be a slippery slope. Anytime a witness.
But you had the President of the United States under oath. In a deposition saying, it's how you define it, what's the definition of a is.
Right.
And he lost his license.
Sure.
He offered his license back. He was fined several $100,000 for what the definition of is when he was explaining what his testimony was in the deposition.
That's right.
The President of the United States.
Yeah, I guess the distinction is that, you know, in this case, there was evidence. There was evidence, and the only evidence was that his testimony was absolutely true. It wasn't even misleading.
Well, is it true that this was not disclosed in his CV, did not come up in a deposition, and then so opposing counsel, whenever this guy pads his credentials or chooses his words so selectively that somebody might later be able to say he didn't lie, to add that he's involved in that the government's hired him in the Fort Hood investigation, and then opposing counsel then has to decide, well, do I ask him about that so he gets to elaborate on his grandeur, or do I just leave it alone and decide and look later to see if he really was?
May I respond?
Please do.
Okay. So, well, two things. I think that the first issue is that there wasn't any sort of hiding of the ball here. I mean, it wasn't on the CV because he hadn't yet been retained when he gave the CV to opposing counsel. So that really isn't an issue. But as to, and I forget the second part of your question.
Well, since this particular qualification wasn't previously disclosed, wasn't updated.
That's a strategic decision. I mean, trial counsel has to decide, do I want to open that door?
Or is it fair to assume that the guy's not telling me a lie?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair to assume that the person is not outright lying, but if a question's ambiguous, a question doesn't require him to say anything yes or no, then it's your job to make it a decision. Do I want to ask a question I don't know the answer to get more clarification so that I might be able to use it to impeach him, or do I just let it go? And trial lawyers make those kinds of strategic decisions all the time. But that doesn't mean that they can just not do their jobs and then, you know, say that this was the biggest issue in the case, which is what's happening here. I mean, if this was such an important issue, why wasn't that question asked? It was a simple question. You know, tell me a little bit more about the work you did. Who did you work for? And at the end of the day, as far as the issues for which that testimony was elicited, it just had to do with his qualifications, and it was only one element of his qualifications. There was tons of other evidence.
You're talking about materiality there, but let me ask you this. Didn't the defense, in fact, have this information? Didn't they have the information about
the
site
worked for this information
at the time?
Yeah, Iris Daly was the expert witness that was retained by the plaintiff to look into Mr. Aiken, to find out about him, and to help counsel prepare for his deposition. She had the article that, you know, said, or the alleged article that said that Mr. Aiken was working on behalf of the defense. So, I mean, obviously as an expert witness, she's an agent of the plaintiff, and just like her attorneys, his attorney is an agent of the plaintiff. So it's difficult for me to understand how that's newly discovered. And I think that the trial counsel, this was also brought up in at trial. Mr. Waters made a statement that before Mr. Aiken testified that he was going to talk about the Fort Hood shooting. Nothing was done then prior to the testimony to find out, you know, what the role was.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that? Prior to trial, they said?
No, it was not prior to trial, but prior to Mr. Aiken's testimony. They filed an oral motion to strike Mr. Aiken, which they ultimately withdrew, you know, basically because he had tons of qualification. And in response to that oral motion, Mr. Waters said, well, look, this guy's going to talk about the Fort Hood shooting case. And at that point, this was before Mr. Aiken's, I think, had even landed in St. Louis. And at that point, they didn't go and try to find out, you know, exactly what his role is. I mean, they did that after trial. He called, Mr. Taylor called Iris Daly and said, hey, what's this Fort Hood investigation all about? And at that point, they found this article that she had in her possession and were able to bring that to the court's attention. Had that been done at trial, we wouldn't be here.
To find that his testimony is technically true, do we have to interpret retain to be paid by?
Well, I think you have to interpret it in the only way it was presented to the court, and that is in the affidavit of Colonel Poppy, where he said that we retained him, we hired him, and we paid him. And it's a little bit different in the criminal justice system. I mean, both the defense counsel and plaintiff's counsel are retained under the same statute, by the same convening authority for special courts martial.
Because my question is, retain normally has, it's a term of art,
sure,
somewhat, a legal term of art, which means not only you pay, but you pay so the person performs services for you.
And the government did pay him, and he did do services
for
the government.
But you have a retained expert. Someone retained for trial is for a particular party.
Right.
You're retained.
Right, right. And the party was the government. I mean, it was a government. So the defense squad and these...
So is there a conflict of interest since the government's
well,
the party
it,
on both
that's
sides?
That's actually an issue. I mean, in this type of court-martial proceeding, the rules are a little bit different. And it's a separate entity within JAG.
That's my question, because
right. You're
saying it's not simply the government paid him. You're saying technically...
He did, in fact, you know, work for the government. He worked for the defense, which is the government.
You're saying JAG is different than outside
than the civil, than the regular civilian criminal justice system.
You'll have time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. I think what that spirited discussion is getting at is that from time to time, this court and the Court of Appeals have had occasion to remind litigants and the general public alike that an appellate court is, in the words of a 1913 Court of Appeals case, not a court of first instance but of review. The result that Midwest's appeal in this case commands is just another reminder of this old maxim. And this is because what Midwest is really appealing amounts to a series of express credibility determinations made by the trial judge, which led him to order a new trial. And respectfully, your honors weren't present at the trial in this case. Heck, I wasn't present at the trial in this case either, but the trial judge was. And for nearly 120 years, the law of Missouri, and as Judge Stith pointed out, you know, we cite every single case where a Missouri appellate court has reviewed an order granting a new trial due to false testimony that affected a jury's verdict. For nearly 120 years, in all those cases, the law of Missouri has been that the review in this case isn't in any way de novo. It must be constrained to the highest degree of deference known in our law, abuse of discretion with, as the court pointed out, an even more deferential eye than usual toward affirming. Now, in what are entirely determinations of credibility based largely on what this court previously has called trial intangibles, the trial court concluded Mr. Aiken was not credible, in fact, that he had testified falsely, and that the effect the false testimony had on the jury was that it likely resulted in an improper verdict. In our legal system, it's not an appellate court's place to second-guess those conclusions. And this court said that time and time again in so many different contexts.
If the words stated were true, How is that a credibility determination?
The trial judge determined that the words stated were not true. And it's replete in his order. And he says, and this is on page 264 of the legal file, it strains credulity past the breaking point to suggest that when Aiken heard the question at trial whether he was retained by the U.S. government, he thought he was being truthful by giving his answer without any clarification that he was working for the defense of Major Hassan and not on behalf of the U.S. government. The trial court found this was not true. There's nothing technically true about it. It was false. And the trial judge had discretion to find that. He sat through the trial. He saw the effect it had on the jury. And, in fact, he remarked on that.
What about opposing counsel notes that he was paid by the U.S. government, and in the military, in effect, everybody works for the U.S. government. So on one level, it was true. Given that, did the trial court have discretion to find it false?
Absolutely, the trial court had that discretion. I think Judge Breckenridge's question to opposing counsel reflected on the parties. The prosecution of Major Hassan is United States versus Hassan. Mr. Aiken was working for Mr. Hassan. He was retained by Mr. Hassan's defense. He was not retained by the United States. And as we all generally know in reviewing criminal opinions, when the Eighth Circuit is saying who the plaintiff is in a criminal prosecution, they always refer to them as the government, capital G. So when you say you're working for the U.S. government, as the trial court clearly understood here and the effect he saw it had on the jury, Mr. Aiken was saying that he was working for the prosecution of Mr. Hassan. And the trial judge says this made an immediate and favorable impression on the jury and on the court, and it no doubt made a similar impression on the jury. And he had discretion to find that.
How is the answer to this question material to the central issue at trial?
It is material because it's when we're talking about materiality, opposing counsel wants to couch materiality as meaning the same thing as it does, de facto in criminal perjury cases. It doesn't necessarily. What it is that it has to be, it has to have impacted the jury's verdict, has to have led to an improper verdict. And he found that. And he certainly could, because,
Wasn't there many qualifications to establish this person to be an expert?
There are many qualifications,
and this
yes.
is just one component or one answer to one question?
But the trial judge notes the effect that it had on the jury. And in the Donati case, this court says that that's part of the court's discretion, too, based on the trial intangibles, that he has the ability to, the trial judge has the ability to sit there, hear the evidence, see the jury, feel, the intangible feeling that the testimony elicits
but
at trial.
Our cases make clear, it's not that because he worked for the defense he was less credible, and that certainly would not be proper. No. The issue is whether or not the jury should be aware that he tried to embellish or falsify his credentials, and his willingness to do that as to his credentials, we said in our prior case, could be concluded by the jury to indicate a willingness to lie about other things in his testimony.
Certainly
this court would never suggest that it's appropriate or inappropriate to hold it. Makes someone more or less qualified depending on which side of a case they testified on?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, I do defense in criminal cases myself. I wouldn't want to think that I'm, less important because
of that.
I
want to make sure we're clear of that. No. And that's why it's material, because in our prior case, which I wrote and I forget the name of, we said that credibility is always central if it shows a willingness to lie in the very case that's at issue.
Certainly. And I believe that's the Mitchell case from this court in 2010. Where this court said cases broadly define materiality in the global context to include statements affecting credibility. It's interesting that we're talking about an expert's qualifications. I found a Florida case, which we cite in our brief, and it's Klein versus States from 1984, where a witness, an expert witness, was convicted of perjury, and the conviction was upheld on appeal because he lied about his qualifications, one facet of his qualifications. This court and the Missouri Court of Appeals throughout the last century have also heard several cases where a witness withholds something about their history that could have, as you pointed out, Judge, indicated a propensity to lie or something like that. And even though it's one little statement, that's enough to convict them of perjury.
Didn't the Mitchell case, though, it was significant as to what he lied about. It was not that he lied about anything. It was the particular nature. And isn't that different than this case?
Actually, no, Your Honor. In Mitchell, it was very similar. It was about a physician who wasn't allowed to be cross-examined as to a false interrogatory answer concerning his qualifications.
No, it was regarding whether or not he had a disciplinary action for killing his mother or something. It was not just a misstatement in his qualification.
But this court said that fact was irrelevant and was a collateral matter and could not come in. It was only his lie about it in answers to interrogatories that was relevant because it might indicate he was willing to lie in his testimony in court.
That's correct, yeah. And so the cross-examination, the denial of the cross-examination was error, and this court reversed under an abuse of discretion standard, incidentally. Here, I mean, it's just manifest. You know, opposing counsel calls this arbitrary. So they say that the trial judge's decision was arbitrary. I've never seen an 11-page order on a single issue like this that could possibly be called arbitrary, and this was not arbitrary.
There's a third thing that could be involved when you say you work for the government, especially on something of such a notoriety as the Fort Hood killings. For example, the Waco investigation with Branch Davidians, Senator Danforth was called in as a blue ribbon investigator with Ed Dowd, former U.S. Attorney Ed Dowd, and a blue ribbon group to actually go through the Waco Branch Davidian thing as a separate investigation, not representing the prosecution, not representing the defense. And so when you say you work for the government, that puts an air of credibility on that on your statement. It may not be the same as if I work for the public defender or I work for the prosecutor.
That may well be true. And, you know, I suppose, Judge, even in that circumstance, he would have been hired by the executive branch of the U.S. government, who does the prosecutions, and not something like an Army defense. But I could see that, but that's not this case. I think what's so interesting about the prior cases dealing with exactly this issue in this procedural posture is that so many of them are so short. The Lee case, the Donati case, disposes of the issue in a paragraph, saying, well, you know, the judge had discretion to find this. He found the guy wasn't credible. He found that the false testimony affected the jury's verdict. Therefore, we're constrained by our standard of review to affirm.
Do we have to find that it constituted perjury, or is it enough that if it was willfully intending to mislead the jury?
That's a very good question. I think it's interesting that the first time this winds up being called perjury is actually several cases into, and in our brief, we cite all the cases that discuss this, it's several cases in. This really isn't equated to criminal perjury until the Loveless case in 1958. The Rick Road case in 1891, the first case to discuss this, actually, because back then in the 19th century, it wasn't entirely clear that judges had the ability to grant a new trial. And finally, in Rick Road, following a couple of earlier cases, the Court of Appeals in St. Louis said, well, you know, he can, and it's for this reason. It doesn't have anything to do with perjury. What it has to do with is the trial court's assessment that there was a fair trial. And if he in any way believes that the trial was unfair, he has a duty to order a new trial.
But if the judge adjures the term unfair versus perjury, that makes a difference, doesn't it? I mean, perjury is a term of art.
Perjury is a term of art, but for example, what I was getting at, Your Honor, in the Rick Road case is they define it as false testimony that impacts the jury's verdict. Those are two elements. They're kind of similar to the criminal perjury standard, but they're not the same. And I think this is exemplified by the Donati case in 1949, where the trial judge, sua sponte, goes outside the motion for new trials grounds and says, I think this one witness was false, and I'm going to order a new trial on that basis, even without any new evidence, simply because, one of your honors asked this to opposing counsel, can the judge just say, I don't believe him, so I think it was Judge Draper, right? I don't believe him, is that enough? And yes, as the Donati case points out, that's enough. If based on his assessment of the trial, he believes the answer was false, and it negatively impacted the jury's verdict, even without more, he can, and that's not an abuse of discretion.
Suppose the answer is not false. Suppose we're having a trial of whether the earth rotates around the sun or the sun rotates around the earth. Okay? The witness testifies the earth rotates around, the sun rotates around the earth, okay? Or the earth rotates around the sun, which is true, correct?
Sure.
The trial judge determines the witness has lied, that's false. I'm ordering a new trial, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the Court of Appeals says, No, wait a minute. That's true.
In that circumstance, Your Honor, I think what you'd be dealing with is one of the exceptions to the judicial notice rule. And a court can take judicial notice of a physical fact like, you know, today is Wednesday or the earth rotates around the sun, not the other way. Here, in order to find that, this court would have to engage in fact-finding. Here, this is, I mean, to say that this was true, it wasn't false, this isn't a physical fact that the court can take judicial notice of. It's based largely, as the White case points out from a couple years ago, on trial intangibles. What was the judge's perception of the palpable feeling of the trial? What effect did this have on the jury based on looking at the witness and seeing how
he answered? You don't think the judge abuses discretion when he says the witness testified falsely when, in fact, the witness didn't? When, in fact, it was true?
In this case,
the earth does rotate around the sun?
If it, again, Your Honor, if it were a physical fact, like if the judge says this is, you know, this is Tuesday, and in fact the court could take judicial notice that that date was on Wednesday, obviously that would be something I think in that limited circumstance.
The court would have abused its discretion.
Yes, in that case the court would have abused its discretion. I agree, but that's not this case. Here, in order to find that, the court would have to engage in fact finding whether. Mr. Akin was being truthful or not was a matter for the trial court. And the trial court found, based on credibility, based on trial intangibles, based on its own assessment of the evidence and the course of trial, and furthermore, way more importantly, the order in which the actual involvement of Mr. Akin and Major Hassan's defense was uncovered. That's very important, too. And, you know, it wasn't just, as opposing counsel suggests, that this was discovered later. It actually had been taken down from his website. Also, just to clear something up, opposing counsel suggested that Ms. Daly had been hired by the plaintiff to weigh Mr. Akin. That's not true at all. She was hired as the plaintiff's own blood spatter expert. I think it's interesting that all of her testimony is missing from the transcript. So there's not really a whole lot for them to rely on there. And another thing to clear up that opposing counsel had said about some phantom oral motion that's not in the record that his involvement in the Fort Hood case had been disclosed before trial, that's nowhere in the record. I'm not familiar with that. My co-counsel sitting at table there said that's absolutely not true at all. Ms. Daly was simply the plaintiff's blood spatter expert, and like many experts, when you're faced with an opposing expert, counsel said, hey, there's this guy Akin, can you look into her, to him? And she did, and she saw on his website, you know, some stuff, but nothing in the CV or in the potential deposition or the interrogatories or anything like that mentioned Fort Hood. She didn't think it was important, and it had been taken down from his website by the time trial counsel looked at it. And Judge Sweeney found that was a huge point. There's simply no way that this court can say this was an abuse of discretion. Our law doesn't allow it. The court should affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you.
Let's hear further questions. Thank you.
So if the judge was not specific, if a motion had been made saying the evidence does not support the verdict, and the judge said, well, I viewed the case and that's true, and I'm going to give a new trial, would you have a case say abuse of discretion if he wasn't specific?
If the judge just wasn't specific as to why he granted it, well, I think, I mean, if he...
Does he have to give reasons?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, if there's a motion saying that the verdict's against the weight of the evidence, then I don't suppose he does, but that wasn't the case. I think when you make a motion based on perjury, the courts have made it quite clear, and I think the reason for that is because perjury is a rather grave accusation, and it affects not only the parties, but the witness who's being accused of perjury.
What's your response to the case cited by your opponent that there's perjury light?
There's perjury what?
Light.
Perjury light. Well, I don't read that. And in reading the decisions of this court, the 2003 decision in the Hancock case and the prior decision in Loveless, there's no perjury light. You have to willfully and deliberately testify falsely. It's almost the same as the perjury statute.
That's a subjective issue, though, isn't it? I mean, if you're intending to testify falsely, or is it objective? Is it something can look and say, what does this word mean in a dictionary sense? But the trial court looked at the word retained. There was an affidavit that said he was retained by the government for the defense, And he said, that's using it differently. I think he was purposely using this to mislead the jury. Is that a subjective call that he gets to make, or is there an objective standard we decide what retained means?
I think true or false is an objective standard. I mean, I think if it's...
Well, but if it's intent to mislead and testify falsely, even if you're wrong, if you think you're right, it's certainly not perjury. So
right.
There has to be a subjective...
Well, I mean, the United States Supreme Court...
So if I have a salad and a hamburger for lunch, and my wife asked me, what'd you have for lunch, and I thought I had a salad... meet your standard of truthfulness. Can you vouch for me on that tonight?
I could not convict you of perjury. I mean, good counsel would ask you a follow-up question. What else did you have, for lunch?
So they have to.
Yeah, you have to, and that's sort of the point of this is that the United States Supreme Court has said that even, in federal perjury cases, even when the witness is willfully evasive, as long as it's technically true. There's no perjury. Now, Missouri doesn't go that far, but that is a standard that's been employed by a rather important court. And we don't need to go that far, because in this case, it was completely true. Couple of things about comments about the citations. The argument that trial counsel didn't know about this article until after the testimony of Mr. Aikens is just not true. Page 727 of the transcript, Mr. Waters, this is in response to their motion to strike.
Now we're not talking about perjury in this hearing, mind you. We're not true or not true in this hearing.
Right. But during trial, before Mr. Aikens testified, we say he's right now doing the entire government investigation for the Fort Hood shooting. He's been qualified as an expert in blood splatter all over the United States. That was stated before his testimony, so that's just not true. As far as Ms. Dally's deposition, that's set forth in full in the legal file, and she did say that part of her job, part of her retention, was to look into Mr. Aiken. That is in the record. And finally, I would just remind the court that if there was a counter affidavit here, if there was something, it's plaintiff's burden. It's plaintiff's showing. Plaintiff has to make a showing that there was perjury. Here, there was no showing. There was no counter affidavit, nothing supporting what they're claiming was a false statement, whereas we had affidavits showing that what Mr. Aiken testified to was absolutely true, and under any standard of review, a new trial was not warranted. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case will be taken under submission.